Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Professor Joan Williams, is back to continue our discussion about her new book, Outclassed, How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. When she was on a few weeks ago, we could not get to all of your emails and phone calls, and there were a lot, so we decided to invite her back. Professor Joan Williams has spent many years researching social inequality, class, race, and gender, so she understands why Democrats lose and Republicans win. She says if the left wants to win, they must change the class dynamics driving U.S. politics. The question is, how? If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Joan Williams is an award-winning scholar of social inequality. She's professor of law and Hastings Foundation Chair Emerita at the University of California College of the Law, San Francisco. Professor Williams is the author of many books, including White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America, and has published on class dynamics in the New York Times, the New Republic, and other publications. Her latest book is Outclassed, How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. Hi, Professor Williams. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for the return invitation. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you. We just had so many emails and phone calls last time around, and this is such an important conversation. So thank you for joining us again. This time, I wanted to ask you to begin with, given that you have done so much research, I mean, reading your book, there's so many notes in this book. You have so many interesting just research studies, so much interesting data that you have brought to us. When people ask you, how did this happen? How did Trump win again? How do you answer that question?
Well, it's actually pretty easy. We didn't listen to the message when he won the first time. Americans, especially Americans in the middle, are really hurting because they have seen the American dream fading. Virtually all Americans used to do better than their parents, but for those born in 1980, it's just an even shot. So there's a huge amount of economic anger out there. And there are basically two kinds of populism. Left populism, which is they're robbing you blind. Right populism, which is they're looking down on you. And the left has not leaned, or Democrats have not leaned into they're robbing you blind. The Kamala Harris campaign started out using some of that language, but then reportedly, under pressure from donors, she backed off it and focused instead on defense of democracy and abortion rights, which poll really high among college graduates, but way, way down among the non-college grads that Democrats have lost. And so the Democrats have not leaned into the they're robbing you blind theme, and they have inadvertently reinforced at every turn the they're looking down on you theme. And ironically, Rose, at this point, the defense of democracy is reinforcing that right populism they're looking down on you theme. Because, first of all, these people, and this includes, as you know, a sharp shift away from Democrats among non-college people of color, especially men of color.
Yeah.
I've not listened to the fact that these folks care more about the end of the month than the end of democracy. And so, first of all, we're not listening to them. And secondly, the kinds of characterizations, and I'm, you know, as I say, I'm just like a caricature of a San Francisco liberal, spent 40 years studying race, class, and gender. And, you know, my friendship group very regularly says these people are dumb, deplorable, dim-witted, and duped. That's just reinforcing the right populism theme of they're looking down on you. So it's really a struggle between whether we're going to focus on the economic elites, we often call them the 1%, who actually created the economic conditions that these people are so angry about, or whether the economic elites are going to be successful in deflecting the anger on cultural elites, the top 20%, on the grounds they're looking down on you.
Joan, I was curious to see articles about people who decided not to vote this time, because we don't talk about them much. Overall, 90 million people did not vote in 2024. That's more than Harris and Trump received. So 90 million people sat it out. The Rolling Stone had a piece by Tessa Stewart. Democrats lost them. Here's why 2020 Biden voters sat out the 2024 election. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this. Tessa Stewart reports that in Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, and North Carolina, there were at least 937,000 Democratic voters who turned out in 2020 but did not show up for Harris. And Trump won those states by about 531,000 votes. So Tessa Harris talked to some of these people. One woman said that she attended a Harris rally, but she left early after Harris failed to address the issues that matter to her. And then Tessa Harris writes, and I'm sorry, you know, for people who care about immigrants and LGBTQ people, but we really have to talk about these issues. But I think a lot of people on the left and Democrats really don't know how to talk about these issues, and that's one of the problems. So non-voters had other gripes with the Harris-Walz campaign too. A surprisingly common frame was that the campaign was not serious, with many citing Harris's celebrity endorsements and event appearances and framing them negatively. Voters across groups indicated a belief that Democrats were focused on the wrong things, with Black men in particular expressing their feeling that Dems cared more about immigrants, trans people, and waging war in Ukraine and Gaza than domestic priorities or their daily economic realities. Young voters, on the other hand, took issue with Harris's perceived silence on Gaza, with a majority of voters in that focus group saying her unwillingness to take a stand affected their decision not to vote. So there's a lot here, Joan, but we really need to unpack this.
Yeah, I think we really do. I mean, I think the one important point is that the woman who left, I mean, first of all, let's just say Rome wasn't built in a day. This problem was not created by Kamala Harris. I think it's really important not to sort of see the Black woman who was facing what's often called a cliff. She was put in a no-win situation. And she didn't win in a no-win situation. What I'm talking about is 40 years of Democratic politics. And I'm talking about deep cultural patterns that go far beyond any election. So that said, she did not put, I mean, the polling shows that defense of democracy was way, way, way up for voters who voted for Harris, and way, way, way down for voters who voted for Trump. And what they wanted to hear about, and this was particularly true of men and particularly true of men in color, of men of color, was inflation and the economy. And she did not put that front and center. So, you know, that awful ad of like Harris cares about they, them. Trump cares about you. Mm-hmm. I thought a lot about that ad. It was reportedly a very effective ad. And there is no doubt in this in God's green earth that attracted transphobic voters. Obviously, it attracted transphobic voters. But it also attracted a lot of voters who said, why aren't they talking about my central issues? You know, eggs cost $7 an hour. That's what I want to talk about. So I think it's really important to put economic issues at the center. Now, we often hear saying this means putting blue-collar jobs at the center, and certainly that's the way Trump interpreted it. And at some level, that's also the way the Biden administration interpreted to a certain extent. And blue-collar jobs and manufacturing jobs in particular, they're really important. They're really important. But they're really important partly because they gave people a stable middle-class standard of living so you could have one full-time job with job security and benefits. And I think I mentioned last time, you know, if wages had continued to rise when productivity did, wages would be 43% higher than they are today. Instead, wages rose 6 or 8 times faster than productivity. That's what people are angry about. And the other shocking thing to me, and I'm sure to you, is that young people swerved to away from Democrats 19 points. Mm. So basically, inequality has gotten so bad in the U.S. that we have a dazzling opportunity for a coalition between this missing middle people, often called blue collar, of all races that are economically furious, and young people who often can only get gig work. They sure as heck can't buy a house. They often can't afford childcare. There is now economic anger among young college graduates, too, because inequality has gotten so bad, not even they can access a stable middle-class standard of living. And I don't think, you know, I think it's another thing that's, I think, gone awry is people blaming the trans issue for Harris's loss. I don't think that's what's going on. I now quote John Fetterman. John Fetterman said, you know, if you get your jollies by jollying trans kids, I think you need another job. So you notice what he's doing. He's kind of channeling the same kind of masculinity that that Trump channels. It's like, there's kind of that swagger, right? He's not saying, you know, let's all join together and victimize these kids. But on the other hand, what we have found is that putting those kids at the center, not to say Democrats did it, I don't think they did, but doesn't help those kids and just fuels the far right because it fuels this narrative of, here are these people looking down on me because I have reservations about X, Y, and Z.
Well, and on this one, Joan, we briefly talked about this last time, but this is such a hard one because Republicans do this so well, punching down.
They do.
But there are consequences, right? I mean, according to Truthout, Republicans spent nearly $215 million on TV ads attacking trans rights this election. And I always apologize for this because I feel really bad talking about it like this, but we have to. I mean, there are LGBTQ people saying, can we just live our lives? Why do we always have to be at the center of these conversations? And to talk about the consequences, a piece just came out 2 days ago from NBC. There were 932 anti-LGBTQ incidents across the U.S. over the past year, from hate speech and bomb threats to fatal violence, with more than half of these acts targeting trans and gender nonconforming people, according to a new report from the LGBTQ advocacy group GLAAD. And I don't know if you've heard about this, Joan, but I just read this horrible story. Jonathan Joss, who's an actor best known for his voice role on King of the Hill, just died in a shooting in San Antonio, Texas. And his husband says he was shot by a man who yelled homophobic slurs. So it's devastating what is happening to the LGBTQ community. And we should also say this is Pride Month.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. It is for sure. And as you know, I hold up the gay marriage campaign as the model of how as a model of our path forward. And I don't know if you want me to go into that again. Should I go there or a different direction?
Sure. No, please, because you have a really interesting chapter about it in your book.
Yeah. The gay marriage campaign, as someone who has worked on race, class, and gender for 40 years, is the single dazzling success in my lifetime. And so I really tried to delve deeply into what they did that was so effective and interviewed a colleague of mine here at UC Law, Matt Coles, who headed up the ACLU's Marriage Equality Project. And Matt, he reminded me that the gay liberation movement did not start out focused on gay marriage, not at all. They were focused on sexual liberation much more broadly. They were focused on legal rights for a wide range of intimacies. And they thought marriage was not something they were too particularly interested in. Matt said that his view changed after he and his colleagues got a domestic partnership law passed in California, and the Alameda County court clerk threw a party. And she said, and he said, like, I'm not even going to go. This is really performative. But he said that he watched people. One of the things she organized is kind of a grand procession down the grand staircase. And he said, I saw those people coming down the stairs, and they weren't doctors or lawyers. They were ordinary, average people. And I said, I get it now. It's the prom and the wedding and everything rolled into one. And they're finally able to say, Mom, yeah, I got married. And what he realized is that the movement had to follow, quote, our people, and that the marriage is what our people wanted. In other words, they ceded the power to set priorities to non-elites. Now, they didn't say, oh, let's stop advocating for LGBTQIA rights. They didn't say that. They just said, how can we build the strongest coalition that connects with the moral intuitions of ordinary average people? That's going to be our best path forward. And they also changed messaging, by the way. They stopped focusing so much on legal rights, which are things that appeal most to liberals who are, I hate to say, demographically, they are richer and whiter than the rest of the country. And they focused instead on the language of commitment, which is much more consonant with moral intuitions in the missing middle. But the only reason they could change messaging is that they changed priorities. And I think that that's, you know, it's maybe an uncomfortable message, but that's what worked. So I think many people who notice that, for example, I mean, you know, the group who is most likely to say they're moderates in the country, Rose, it's black people. And most people who focus on this kind of, I mean, the progressive activists are 8% of Americans, and they're much more educated and much more white than the general population. Now, people who focus on this often say, oh, well, that just means we should, you know, all become centrists. And that is actually, you know, research does help. So that's actually not accurate either, because people who say they're moderate, they're not necessarily centrists. They may hold extreme positions, but they hold a different mix of positions than your average progressive activist. So the challenge is to figure out what are those values that we can champion that will connect with the moral intuitions of non-college graduate and pull society in a progressive direction.
Today, we're spending the hour with Professor Joan Williams to continue our discussion about her book, Outclassed: How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. Joan Williams is professor of law and Hastings Foundation Chair Emerita at the University of California College of the Law, San Francisco. She's an award-winning scholar of social inequality. You can join us at 866-798-8255. Joan says, if the left wants to win, they have to change class dynamics driving U.S. politics. What are your thoughts on this? Now that we have seen the numbers, we've seen what people have said about why they stayed home, why they didn't vote, why they switched their vote. What are your thoughts about where we are right now and where we're going? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Joan, we're getting a few emails about Kamala Harris's decision to campaign with Liz Cheney. Suzanne writes, "I'm a lifelong Democrat. I am 81. I did not vote. Once she started campaigning with Liz Cheney, that was it." And I found an interesting piece by The Nation's John Nichols. You know, he lives in Wisconsin, and he points out that Kamala Harris made her first campaign appearance with Liz Cheney in, I think it's at Ripon, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And John writes, "The Cheney strategy was an abject failure that added few, if any, votes to the Democratic total, alienated voters who had no taste for the former GOP representative's neocon extremism, and stole precious time from an agonizingly short campaign schedule. Why it is certainly not the sole exception for why Democrats fared as poorly as they did, the Cheney detour was a political fiasco." What are your thoughts about that? And that decision was made because of democracy. And to your point, a lot of people said democracy was not even near the top of their list. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it wasn't at the top of their list because they look at the last 40 years, this missing middle, and they say, like, democracy has failed us. And they're kind of right. I mean, their wages are 43% lower than they should be. So at some level, painful as it is to say, democracy has failed them. And one of the reasons that it has is because when Democrats often try to sort of go the route of Republican light. And again, I just want to loop back to a point about Kamala Harris. I mean, the idea that she wasn't serious because of the celebrity endorsements, I mean, that's a really common form of racial bias and gender bias, too. I mean, I've done, you know, decades of studies that study race and gender in organizations. And women in general, African Americans in general, and Black women in particular, they're just seen as not serious. They're seen as not a good fit for roles with authority. So there's a lot of racial bias that's going on here. But that said, the idea that the way you reach voters and create a majority coalition is to go moderate is an example. The Liz Cheney romance is an example of that, and the focus on defense of democracy is an example of that. We've talked about why centering defense of democracy was not a way to win the voters that Democrats needed to win. And also, we talked about why going moderate was not a way to win the voters that Democrats need to win. Almost two-thirds, Rose, of Americans lack college degrees. Why was the decision to go after moderate Republicans? Two-thirds of Americans lack college degrees. Often it's the sense that to connect with the working class, first of all, they're assumed all to be white. They aren't. And the last election really showed that they aren't, because we had these, you know, 30-point swing away from Democrats, from non-college people of color, and over 40-point swing away from Democrats by young people of color. So the alternative to going Republican light is to pick up the Bernie vote and to say, all right, a lot of what's driving this politics of distraction is economic anger, which Republicans have really learned how to sculpt into masculinity contests, into culture wars, into racism. We got to sculpt it back. But the first thing we need to do to go back to the central theme is focus on left populism. They're robbing us blind, and not fuel right populism. They're looking down on us.
So one of the questions is, what economic message is the Democratic Party going to embrace moving forward? I think that's one of the key messages, because in a Guardian piece about people who did not vote, They said no candidate represented working or middle class interests and people like themselves. This includes several people who voted in the previous two elections but decided not to vote this time. We're going to take a quick break. Today we're joined by Professor Joan Williams. We're continuing our discussion about her book, Outclassed: How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. In her book, she has so many studies about how neoliberalism has affected people across this country, how their wages have been flat. In many cases, children are doing worse than their parents. People just cannot afford to live. And so what is the economic message of the Democratic Party moving forward? What are your thoughts? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we're spending the hour with Professor Joan Williams, author of Outclassed: How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. As she's got so many very important research in her book. She writes that wages have increased by 83% for college graduates since 1989, but hardly at all for non-college graduates. The college wage premium doubled between 1980 and 2000. The 40% wage differential between college grads and non-college grads rose to 80%. So the question is, what economic message, what economic policies will the Democrats embrace in the coming years? What are your thoughts on this? 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We've got a number of messages from listeners about class and economics. Howard writes, "Let's be honest, the Democratic Party went astray under the leadership of the Clintons. They moved the party toward dependence on corporate funding, and Hillary's campaign often insulted the lower classes." You write about this a lot in your book, Joan, about neoliberalism and the neoliberal policies that Bill Clinton embraced.
I do. And we understand, and we've been talking about how neoliberalism fueled inequality between individuals. What's less widely understood is how neoliberalism fueled inequality between regions. 96% of the job growth in recent decades and 73% of the employment gains have been focused on about 50 major metropolitan areas. And if you look at the electoral map in the United States, you can see the result. You see that ocean of red in the middle of the country, and then blue coasts and a few little blue dots. So neoliberalism is definitely one of the key engines. It's also, by the way, changed elites in the way that has fueled the conflict between this missing middle and the top 20%. But I wanted to go back to what economic message should Democrats be sending. It's just so crystal clear if you read what I've read, which is very simple. Hard work should pay off in a stable middle-class life, period. That's it. That's true. That's going to appeal to the young people for whom that's not true. That's going to appeal to the missing middle for who are often holding like 5 part-time jobs with no benefits and no future. Very often when Democrats talk about economic issues, they either talk about redistribution, but studies show that the American public, and especially the missing middle, is much more supportive of measures to ensure a fair labor market, what's often called predistribution, than they are of government redistribution. Or Democrats talk about the minimum wage. Now, the minimum wage is really important for poor people, don't get me wrong. It's not going to appeal to this missing middle. So if you're looking for a way to appeal and, again, connect with the moral intuitions of the missing middle, what you should be focused on is hard work should pay off for a state to in a stable middle-class life, and it doesn't anymore. But the other thing we've talked about a little less, unless you want to pull me in a different direction, are what I call the feeling rules of the elite, sort of the structure of our sympathy, who we're supposed to feel emotionally bonded with, whose plight we're supposed to feel pained by. And if you look at the feeling rules of sort of us and the progressives, you know, progressives, we're definitely supposed to feel empathy with immigrants, as we've talked about, LGBTQ and trans kids, people of color, maybe the poor. But feeling empathy for the plight of the missing middle, well, you know, they're the deplorables duped by the enemies of democracy. And so, in other words, the structure of the feeling rules, sorry to talk about like a professor for a minute, is really that we are attuned to many different types of social power, but not to class. That is inevitably going to put a target on the back of immigrants and all those other groups that we care about, because that is so easily weaponized by the far right. They are looking down on you. And I think, you know, many people say, well, you know, we should just sell out trans kids and be done with it. I think, that, you know, empathy is not a zero-sum game. We have to add class to the types of social inequality that we're deeply concerned about.
So when you think about the Democratic Party on these issues, the last time you were on, I played a clip. Bernie Sanders went to a West Virginia county that voted for Trump, and everyone in the audience voted for Trump. And Bernie was talking about the things that Bernie always talks about: health care for all, education for all. And he said education should be free, health care should be free. Obviously, it's paid for by taxes. And he had the place just clapping. And so that's one wing of the party. But then you have the corporate wing of the party. And in this Rolling Stone piece, Tessa Stewart writes, "The same voters who sat out last November have been horrified by what they've watched Trump and Elon Musk do since January. Most of the focus group participants say that they feel strongly motivated to vote in 2026. The groups also offer back insight into what kind of leader might be able to draw voters back to the Democratic Party. Hint, that person is more in the mold of Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez than Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who infuriated the Democratic base when he helped advance the Republicans' partisan spending bill." So that's the other question, Joan. What way is forward for the Democrats? What wing of the party are they going to embrace?
I think, well, if the corporate wing is smart, they will realize that insisting that Democrats don't talk about economic inequalities is going to continue to create number one. They're going to continue to lose. I mean, Republican donors like Rupert Murdoch, they have, I mean, there was a study of Tucker Carlson's show. Tucker Carlson railed against elites in 70% of his shows before 2016. So the left Republican donors are smart enough to know that there's a lot of economic anger and they have to let people express it and somehow connect with it. Democratic donors need to wise up. So that's one really important part. I actually think we have a generational opportunity, as someone who is an incurable optimist, with Doge and with these narcissistic tariffs, these taco tariffs. Doge, it depends, though. We could blow it if we talk about how Doge is laying off climate scientists, college grads. That's not going to be of particular interest to the missing middle, because what Doge has done is created as much instability in the lives of federal workers, most of them college grads, as non-college workers have faced for decades. I mean, when they can't even get a full-time schedule and their hours aren't even announced until the week before. What we should be focusing on in Doge is that using this as a moment of opportunity to explain to people in the missing middle in a respectful way, that many government programs underlie their ability to lead a stable middle-class life. Look at all the cuts to the staffing at Social Security and Medicare. He promised he wouldn't do it. He's doing it. Look at what the cuts to farmers are doing. This includes USAID, by the way, that allowed people to sell their crops abroad. These kinds of, we should be looking at how to message the DOGE cuts, not so we focus on what their impact on college grads, but their impact on non-college grads. And these taco Trumps, I mean, I know you've heard of the Trump always chickens out taco firm, a taco term. That is beautiful because one of the things we have to do is by poking fun at Trump, help people realize this is not a macho man. This is a fragile, anxious individual whose narcissism is disrupting the entire economy and threatening U.S. manufacturing to the extent they have international supply chains, which they do. And these taco tariffs also are threatening one of the main things that this missing middle group was upset about, which was rising prices. Tariffs are price rises. And that's, we have seen, you know, I saw an amazing poll in the last week that used to be that this missing middle cared about the economy and they trusted Republicans more than Democrats on the economy. The tariffs have created such chaos that Democrats and Republicans are now about even in terms of their trust, people's trust on their economy. That is an incredible moment of opportunity. Number one, to use DOGE to explain how government programs underlie the middle class's stable standard of living. And number two, to use the tariffs to show that the Republicans have completely mismanaged the economy and it's going to screw your family in kitchen table ways.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Dell in Oakland. Hi, Dell. Thanks for holding. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. So I've been paying attention, and a third of the population did not vote. And they don't vote because they feel like our Democrats are being run by corporations. Our country is being run by lobbyists and corporations, so their vote does not count. I hear this over and over again. Right. I lost faith in the Democratic Party the way they treated Bernie Sanders when he was running. Bernie was speaking to the people, and the Democratic Party just shunned us. So it makes me feel like the Democratic Party is also run by corporations and lobbyists. That's where, you know, I still vote Democrat because it's the lesser of two evils. But the Democratic Party lost a lot of people because we have no more faith. We feel like it doesn't matter. You know, if we could get that one third of people excited to vote, and I feel like Bernie Sanders was the one, but they did him so dirty.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, Bernie's central message has been that the middle class works hard and deserves a stable life. That's been the central message. I agree that corporations and lobbyists have a huge amount of power in the Democratic Party. On the other hand, they have a huge amount of power in the Republican Party, too. And Republican donors, again, are smart enough to understand that the path to power is to connect with anger of this missing middle. And Democratic donors need to wise up. It's just not an option. Republican light does not appeal to people. There is a reason why AOC and Bernie showed up in very red areas and drew very avid crowds. But the other point I wanted, this has been brought up several times, is if only people had voted. Two of the really shocking things about 2024 is, number one, there is a veer away of even low-income voters from Democrats. people who earn less than $50,000 a year veered away from Democrats. And the other thing is that Trump did a better job than Harris did at mobilizing non-engaged voters. So many of the analyses show that if more people had voted, Democrats would have lost worse. The people who we really need to focus on gaining back more of, and we don't have to gain back a lot of them, but we have to gain back some chunk of them, are what one study called the anti-elites. They were economically very progressive voters, 19% of Trump voters in 2016, and they had racial feelings, the same as non-Trump voters. There was another group of economically progressive voters who was very racist. That ain't going to happen. But these anti-elites had just about the same attitudes as non-Trump voters. Two-thirds of them believed that climate change was a serious problem. They had the highest endorsement of gay marriage of any group. And they were least loyal to Republicans. Many of those people, not all of them, many of them were Bernie to Trump voters. Those are gettable by Democrats without selling our souls.
What would you say, Joan? Someone brought up the cat, they're eating cats and dogs the other day, and I completely forgot about that. What would you say to someone who asked, why would someone vote for the cats and dogs message? Just these bizarre messages. One thing I've been thinking about is after Roe was overturned, there's such a disconnect, and I think media has a lot to do with this, but a lot of people thought that Roe was overturned because of Biden. And so polling came out after, yeah, the New York Times had a piece about this. A lot of polling came out after Roe was overturned, and it found that more people than ever support abortion rights.
I know.
Because they saw what happened after Roe was overturned.
Exactly.
And so a lot of people are wondering
what you wish for.
Right. So if the overwhelming majority support abortion rights, and yet the person who appointed Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe was still able to win, even along with the cats and dogs lie, and then also saying that Democrats kill babies after they're born. I mean, a lot of people are just wondering, they're still wondering, how did this happen?
You know, the assumption behind your question, Rose, is that people voted for him because of the cats and dogs nonsense. They voted for him because of the abortion rights argument. They didn't. Their top issues were inflation and the economy. And the third issue was immigration. And we can talk about why immigration is an issue that works so well for the far right. But their top issues were the economy and inflation. So I think it's really an unhelpful narrative to assume that people are so stupid that they believe that nonsense about eating cats and dogs. That just reinforces the "we're looking down on them" narrative. I think a lot of people who vote for Trump know, they see him. They're smart. They're as smart as we are. They see him for a charlatan. They see him for a narcissist. They wouldn't want him anywhere near their children either. But they're so disillusioned with both parties that they are talking to they are voting with the party that, number one, says it's putting middle class jobs at the center, although it lies. You and I know that, but that's at least what they're saying. And that doesn't have these feeling rules that we've been talking about, where, I mean, and you notice, like, my mind goes to abortion rights too. This was one of my very first political commitments. But there's a demography for people who believe passionately in divorce in abortion rights, and they look like me. They're relatively privileged white women. And that doesn't mean that they're unimportant. That means that every viewpoint is parochial, and that politics aren't about seeking catharsis of, like, I'm so angry at these people. Why are they doing this? Why are they ruining my country? there's a place for that. And, you know, you got to process with your friends. But politics is about building coalitions with people who are fundamentally unlike you, which means you have to take an imaginative leap to understand how the world makes sense to them and how you can connect with them. And I'm sad to say the literature shows that liberals are less good at this than conservatives are. Conservatives are better, shockingly so, at talking across difference. Shocking, but true.
What are your thoughts about the media and how it's changed? Bruce writes, traveling outside of major cities, I was struck by how many communities have only Fox. So all the residents are getting brainwashed by the likes of Rupert Murdoch. We've got billionaires buying newspapers and social media outlets, and they control the messaging. It's why we read about Biden's health in June of 2025, but nothing about the decline in Trump's mental health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I'm not an expert on the media. It's no doubt that the media is playing a huge role. Fox is playing a role, but even more important, social media and the Manosphere podcasts are playing a huge, huge role. And one of the things that Democratic donors are focused on now, to their credit, is trying to build a left media environment, including lots of social media that is going to be that's going to contest the hegemony, as we say, on the left of Fox News and the right.
And in our remaining minutes, Joan, what about immigration? Can you talk about this one? Because I've heard so many people just simply say why they're voting for Trump: immigration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no far-right movement, and I've studied them not only in the United States but abroad, no far-right movement has thrived without putting immigration at the center. And the reason immigration is such a powerful issue for the far right is really three reasons. It combines anxieties about economics. Where have the good jobs gone? It's really easy to blame immigrants, although it's actually that workers no longer get their share of the productivity, right? But the politics of distraction is very effective at deflecting blame onto immigrants. And number two, there are these cultural issues where there's a real culture clash. And again, this goes back to these feeling roles. My crowd is very proud of being members of a cultural of a global elite. I mean, I grew up partly in Venezuela, grew up speaking Spanish, and I can show up in Korea. I'm a distinguished professor. I can carry my social honor with me, and so that's one of the reasons why among college educated people we feel bonded to immigrants. And we feel very connected to them, but people in the missing middle, their lives are super different. First of all, their social honor is not portable, so a huge proportion of the Trump voters lives within 2 miles of where they grew up. They're very, very rooted, and they're much more patriotic than college grads are, and especially people with postgraduate education are, because if you think about it, we're proud of being, you know, my crowd is proud of being part of a global elite. We're stressing our class advantage. But for people in the missing middle, they don't have that. And what they stress, the high status categories they belong to, one of them is that they're very proud they're Americans, and there are both cultural reasons and economic reasons. Now, how do you go about stopping our constant reinforcing of this right populist message that we're looking down on them? First of all, number one, immigrants are really important in the United States to creating a stable middle-class life for people in the missing middle. They're very important for farmers who without immigrants are going to have their crops rotting in the fields. They're very important to control prices, because without immigrants, you're going to have a $25 hamburger. And they're also very important to communicate that, you know, most of these immigrants, they're working class people with working class values, just like the American working class, faith, family, patriotism, and to point out that the very strong trend in American history is that immigrants assimilate. You know, my father used to call Italian food ethnic food. Now we just think of it as American food, right? So it's not that we say that immigrants should have to be in lockstep and diversity is, we're going to abandon diversity. But it's a fact of life. The data shows that immigrants assimilate. And then finally, one of the things that is a very central value to these this fragile and failing middle class is, they're in their jobs. They have to be rule followers, you know, in a pink collar, in a blue collar, and a routine white collar job. If you're disruptive, you just get fired. So they valorize rule following as a way to kind of turn servitude into honor. And so then when they see disorder at the border and an immigration system in shambles, that gets them very upset, and it gets Latinos upset as well, the polling shows. But what's the initial of the person, oh, by the way, who killed the bill that would have created order at the border? It's Trump. Those are the kinds of arguments. But again, just, you know, the billionth story about how this incredibly vulnerable immigrant has been victimized. My heart goes out to it. But you know who we're helping with those stories? We're helping the far right.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, Joan, but thank you again for joining us. Joan Williams is author of Outclassed: How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. She's professor of law and Hastings Foundation Chair Emerita at the University of California College of Law, San Francisco. Thanks so much, Joan.
Really appreciate it, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.